Welcome to the Jeff Knows Inc. Show with your host, Jeff Lopes, where we bring you the world's top athletes, celebrities, entrepreneurs, influencers, and their journeys to success.
We're live in the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have on today Brady Livoid. What is up, brother?
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me. A little bit late of a start. I apologize, but we're here now and super grateful for the space to share my story today.
I love it. You're actually the second Ontario guest we've had. We had one where you're going to be episode 212, 213. I think the other Ontario guest was a buddy of mine. And he was episode either 3 or 4. So it's been a while to have an Ontario boy on here, or not Ontario boy, but a local guest on the show. So I'm excited about this. You have an incredible story. You've been through hell and back, and you're on, I guess, the road to redemption now, and passing your story to help others. Let's just talk about you, man. You can't get more Canadian than NHL or on your way to the NHL hockey player, pro hockey player. And the tragedy of sometimes what drugs and alcohol and what could happen to a young athlete. So I think your story is very important of the path of where it went and what could have happened and what could have been and what is happening now in your redemption of how many people you're probably going to help along the journey. So let's just dive into your story. Like, where did this all start? Like, to start with your hockey journey, like as a kid, when did you start playing hockey? When did you fall in love with the game?
Yeah, I think that's usually right where I go whenever I tell my story, because it's just such a huge piece of it. I think all in around the same time, a lot of things happened, Jeff. So, you know, I fell in love with the game of hockey in the early 1990s. Pavel Bure was new to Vancouver and new to the NHL, and nobody had seen anybody skate like that before.
Yeah,
I mean, I was young. I was at his first game with my dad. He didn't score, but man, he was just electric. Yeah, I swear to God, he had like 100 breakaways that game. I don't know how he didn't score, but he was just going through everybody. And right away, I knew that I wanted to do that. Like, I was little and I saw that and I was like, that's exciting. That's incredible. I want to be that. I mean, should have known better that I wasn't going to be Pavel Bure. But as a kid, that's who I wanted to be. And my dad really loved the game, and you know, I fell in love with it right away. But I think within like 3 months of each other, like boom, boom, boom. I start hockey, fall in love with hockey. My mom leaves my dad to be a single dad. And then like a month or two later, I'm at a family reunion and I'm sexually abused at 5 years old. And, you know, that was something, just first off, you know, today it's not like it's easy to talk about it, but I can say that to you and I share my story and I tell people that. But that wasn't the case up until, I mean, I'm going to be 36 in August, and I didn't tell anybody till I was, I think, 32. Right. So you hear the stories about why people never tell anybody and all that stuff. And I think unless you've lived it, you don't really understand it maybe, but that's what happened to me. And it was really confusing. It was really hard. It was by an older guy. I didn't really know. The guy kind of manipulated me and groomed me and did all those things that you hear about. And that really made me fall in love with hockey more. You know, I was missing my mom, even though my dad's fantastic, great dad. But you just can't replace a mother's love. You've been sexually abused, and then I have hockey. Hockey felt like the only thing in my life that was a constant that made me feel like good, made me not feel scared and terrified and confused and all the things that a 5-year-old, 6-year-old boy like that year would be going through. And so I think I just spent as much time as I could with a stick in my hand, you know, watching hockey while stick handling a golf ball in my front street, all those places, because it really felt good to me. It felt safe. And Jeff, it's no secret, if you do something a lot, you develop certain skills, whether it be hockey, music, business, whatever. You spend time on it and you're going to develop those skills. And that's sort of what happened You know, and I progressed quite nicely through hockey. You know, I played AAA all the way. That was my thing. I was right from day one. I was a hockey player. That was all I was going to be. That's what I identified as. That's what people knew me as. And it felt good, right? There's a lot of, you know, sort of perks right from day one in school with friends and everything. And you just feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. And I loved it. The problem with that though, like you go through school and I started to hear and see people who would get picked on and often bullied, oftentimes for things that weren't even true. Right. You just get labeled as something, or a kid's getting picked on, and you start to hear homophobic slurs and different things. And you start to put two and two together. And where, for whatever reason, during my childhood, all that kind of sexual innuendos and learning and even experimentation happened really young with me and my group of friends, we'll just say. So we had like a pretty good understanding. I think we thought we knew more than we did. But I started to hear homophobic slurs and people get labeled and all this. And so as long as I can remember, I was worried about people finding out what happened to me, because if people find out what happened to me, my life is over. Like, I can't let anybody, we don't even know if this stuff is true. And little Johnny or Jamie is getting picked on and they're crying and they don't want to come back to school. And that's probably not even true. What if these people find out that really happened to me? And so there was that. And then there was this long period of time where I don't have an issue. I got gay friends and I support everybody. But for a long period of time, I thought I was gay because I was abused by an older guy. I was never attracted to men and I always liked girls and all that kind of stuff. But in my mind as a young boy, I had no understanding and I was like so confused. And I was like, oh, I don't know how to do it. And so I just started to fall apart. And you kind of fast forward. I mean, there's a lot of, we could sit here and talk all day about the intricacies of the story. But by the time I was 16, I was playing in the Western Hockey League, which is the equivalent of the OHL out here in Ontario, the best junior league in the world. And, you know, leading up to that, I had not really, I mean, I had had a couple drinks here and there, but never was I going to do drugs. I had a very, very strong stance on that. And it was just a territory I was never going to go. I never in a million years thought I would do drugs. But when I went to the Swift Current, you know, it was an era of bullying, really, hazing. And yeah, the older guys on the team were so horrible to me that now all of a sudden I hated going to the rink. I started to resent hockey. I don't even want to play hockey anymore because I don't know how I'm going to be treated every time I go to the rink. Some really bad stuff happened to me. Some really abusive stuff happened to me and some other guys. And it was sort of just this rite of passage, if you will, that trickled down through each generation of hockey player for many, many years. And actually, it's gotten a lot better, Jeff, but we were one of the last years where it was like really bad. I mean, it's still bad, but it was really bad. And it pushed me to quit the team on three different occasions. First, as a 16-year-old, after my very first game, I got an assist, which would be on paper, like that's success. You got a point in your first game as a 16-year-old. And I remember calling my dad after and being like, I don't know if I want to be here anymore. He's like, what do you mean? You don't like Swift Current? I'm like, no, Dad, I don't know if I want to be alive anymore. Because that was really the first time that I can remember where, like, I don't have anything as an outlet now because hockey's gone. Right. Because I don't even want to go to the rink because of how I'm being treated and all of that that came with it.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Could I dive into that quickly?
Yeah, please.
The hazing aspect. And this is something where it's brought to light more now over the last, I would say over the last 4 to 5 years. You're saying it has, I mean, Ontario, St. Mike's had a huge thing. It was all over the media maybe about 3-4 years ago. So this is still something that's ongoing. I'm sure now it's brought to the light a lot more, but can you give me some examples of like this stupid shit they would do? Like where, I mean, you're one of probably how many thousands of young athletes, hockey. I don't know if it was the culture. Was it more in hockey? Is it very similar in other sports? But I think hockey, where the whole locker room, the environment, the practices, the ice, the arenas, I think it was a lot more involved in hockey. Give me some examples of that so people have an understanding of how, in a way, tortured these young athletes are by the older guys, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's I have no problem sharing some of that. And so just for example, so I was still in high school. A lot of the guys on the team, older guys, they weren't in high school anymore.
Yeah.
So we would go to high school from whatever it was, 8:30 till noon, because we were hockey players, and then we would have to go to practice.
Yeah.
The older guys, they didn't have to go to school, but they would have to go to the rink in the morning, say 10 o'clock in the morning, to do a little check-in so the coaches know they're not sleeping in all day and all that kind of stuff. So they would be at the rink, and I would have to leave school and go right from school, maybe get a quick subway on the way, and come crashing in through the doors almost late for practice, because there just wasn't a lot of time there to go from school to, and I would show up to the rink. And my skates would be missing. My gloves would be missing. I don't know where they are. At first, I never knew where they were, right? And then I would find out they were in the deep freeze or in the ice machine filled with water, frozen solid. So now I'm coming to practice and I got to get a heat gun and I'm trying to, you know, get the ice out of my gloves, ice out of my skates. Meanwhile, I don't want to be a rat. I don't want to run to the coach and be like, oh, guys. And then I'm going to get it even worse. So that was really bad. And then other times, you know, being in the shower and having, you know, a few industrial size bottles, like liters and liters of bleach dumped on my head and into my eyes, and they're mopping me with mops and turning the mop over with broom handles and poking me in the ass and, you know, just really horrible things. Abusive on the bus, making us run the gauntlet on the bus. And they would have pillowcases with dress shoes in them. And you got to run to the back of the bus and touch it and run back. Meanwhile, they're hitting you with dress shoes and pillowcases. I remember getting a concussion doing that. And just like so many other things. And finally, what happened, Jeff, is I was like, oh, I really want to fit in. There was times where I quit and I just didn't want to be there, but I really wanted to be a hockey player. And so I started to fit in, and I remember like going to parties and just being like, okay, well, they're drinking, they're older. Maybe if I do this, then I'll fit in. Right. And what I didn't know is that because of everything that happened to me in childhood, and you know, my story is just one of many like it, but there's also a lot of different stories. Like we all go through things and we all internalize them differently. They all affect us differently. So for me, it might be the sexual abuse or my mom leaving. For somebody else, it could be, you know, being picked on in school or whatever. And you can't really classify which one is worse, because everybody's individual situation is different, and again, they take it differently, they handle it differently. And when I started to drink to fit in, right away, now that I look back on it, I had an issue with it. I never, like, as soon as I started to drink, I couldn't put it down. I'd be the last one, come on guys, like, come on, what are you falling asleep for? Let's get up, there's still booze left or whatever. And I thought I was just being the clown, kind of the hype guy, trying to fit in, trying to be cool. And I found it really hard to put down alcohol. Any chance that I could get, I was all for it. And it started to affect my mental health even more. And then, of course, my hockey and different things. And I struggled immensely through junior hockey, leaving the team on a few different occasions for mental health reasons. And then the one year I just up and packed my truck as an 18-year-old in my draft year. Because I was falling apart mentally and felt like I couldn't tell anybody. I know at different times the coaches would be like, hey, is something wrong? And they got a sports psychologist and they're like, Brady, we can see something's wrong. And I'm like, I'm fine. Because in my mind, I was 17 years old, I think, when I talked to the sports psychologist for the first time. And I was like, if I tell this guy that I'm like thinking about taking my own life pretty much all day, every day, he's going to pull me from hockey. I'm going to lose everything. I have no idea where I'm going to be. I'm like, people are going to make fun of me even more. The team's not going to know, like, really know what's going on, and they'll all have make up stories. And so I was like, I can't tell anybody. I got really good at making sure that nobody knew who I was, what I was going through. And I thought that at the time, I thought that was the only way to handle it. I mean, I was a hockey player. I was supposed to be tough, right? Yeah. I grew up in the era of enforcers, watching guys like Ty Domi and Bob Probert, who I just love to pieces to this day. Like, I still idolize them, but it was this false sense of toughness and what I had to be. And this was 2005, let's say. Things were a lot different when you talk mental health, when you talk addiction. I mean, we have a long ways to go, but it was certainly different back then. Nobody was talking about it. Nobody understood it. And if you were struggling mentally, you weren't strong enough to be a hockey player. You were weak. And good chance you probably should go to what they used to refer to as the loony bin. And I mean, it's not funny to say it, but it's the reality that I went so long trying to make sure nobody really knew what was going on, in fear of losing everything, of ending up in those places. And guess what happened anyways, you know? Like, eventually, because I didn't deal with it, because I kept running and trying to run from myself and run from my problems, I ended up, you know, losing everything. Even, you know, we can kind of talk how I ended up turning pro even after all my, I had crazy antics in junior with drinking and that. But I do want to share one story because I think there's a lot of value in this story, and I always share it whenever I speak, Jeff, is, okay, so I had this really strong stance on drugs. Number one, alcohol is a drug.
Yeah.
Our society, I just don't, I think maybe people know it, but they don't fully understand it. And like you, I grew up in a time where alcohol is legal.
Yeah.
You know, people around me were drinking. Celebrations, everyone's drinking. Go out for dinner, everyone's drinking. Something bad happens, let's drink. Like, any excuse to drink, and it just became sort of normal. So even though I was drinking, and it was, at now looking back at it, it was already starting to be a problem, it wasn't that bad in my mind because everybody was doing it. It's legal. It's not that bad. And, you know, so I went to a music festival after my high school graduation. I went to Merritt Mount Music Festival. It's sort of like Boots and Hearts, if anybody knows what that music festival is in Ontario. Very similar.
Yeah.
It was one of the first times that I went away on my own with my friends, like camping, the whole thing at this music festival. And I packed up my truck with my high school girlfriend, and I had a flats and flats of beer. Like, I was going there to drink. Like, that's, I was going there to party. I was not going there to do drugs. When I got there, within the first couple of hours, a group of people, including a couple of hockey players who I won't name that played in the NHL that I looked up to a lot, that also played in the NHL, they came up to me, and the one guy in particular was like, "Hey, man, you want to take one of these?" And he held his hand out like this. And he had colored pills in his hand. I didn't know what they were. I'd never seen anything like that up to that point. And it was ecstasy or MDMA.
Yeah.
And I was like right away, I was like, no, like I don't do that. And I was also really confused because I was under the impression that hockey players don't do drugs. Like, I don't know. Like, I just grew up with that thought in my mind. Like, they're superheroes. They're athletes. There's no way that hockey players do drugs. And now all of a sudden, a very successful at the time and then later on hockey player offers me these pills. And I was really confused. Like, we're doing this? Like, you guys do this? I'm like, but I don't. I won't. See you later. And we were there for like 4 or 5 days. And it just kept happening. I felt like I was the only one, Jeff, that wasn't doing it. And everyone looked like they were having such a good time. And I was drinking, and I was the third or fourth day. And you know, another group of people, some of the same people came up to me, and they're all messed up, and they got more pills. They're like, "Come on, man, don't be such a wuss. Come on, it's not that bad. Just take it." And I was drunk, which right away lowers your inhibitions, right? I don't know if anybody else can relate to that, but I haven't made too many of the best decisions in my life when I was drinking. Let me tell you, I've made some of the worst ones drinking. And in just a moment of, I don't know what you call it, but maybe peer pressure. I felt like I was missing out. I felt like, hey, maybe it isn't that bad. Maybe I was wrong about this stuff all along, because look at that guy, just played for Team Canada in the World Juniors. He just won a gold medal, and he's in the off season. He's just having a fun night. So I did it. I took one of those pills, and holy shit. Like, I was, again, if I thought alcohol, was doing the trick for making me feel good. They call it the feel good drug. I mean, right away it was like, I wanted to get more of that, because like hockey, I was addicted to hockey because of the way that it made me feel. Yeah. Like throughout childhood, that was my first drug. It was like, I like this because I don't like how I'm feeling up here and in my heart. So I'm going to play hockey. Now all of a sudden it was just in a pill. So every day after that music festival that I could get my hands on it, which was more days than not at 17, almost 18 years old, I started to do it. And it was just like, you break that boundary. I broke that boundary for myself. That was so firm. Like, I was the last guy in my high school. Yeah. I still talk to people that I went to high school with. They're like, we can't believe, out of all the people, like, you were the athlete. You set records in our school for the 12-minute run and for this, and you were going to go off and play in the NHL. And that's what happened. And then, you know, very shortly after that, I was introduced to cocaine. And it was just like a progression of, like, you know, you make that one decision, all of a sudden it's like, well, that's not that much worse than this. Is it any worse? Maybe that one's even worse than this. People are telling me ecstasy is worse than cocaine. Well, I'm like, okay, I don't really know. I'm just following everybody else's lead. And one thing led to the other, and very much the same, like the alcohol, like the ecstasy, the cocaine just took over my life. Somewhere in there though, when I was my 20-year-old season, I still don't have the answer. I got traded to the Kelowna Rockets, and I had a phenomenal year on the ice and off the ice. I think I only drank twice the whole year. There was no drugs. And I finished the year second on team in scoring, which I had more points than JD Benn, who's the captain of the Dallas Stars. You know, I led our team in goals in the first round. And all of a sudden, even though all the scouts knew, because hockey is a small world, they knew that I had been struggling with drugs. They knew that I had quit. They knew that I still was getting contract offers at 20 years old after I quit my draft year. And so now here's this moment that should have been, come on, like, getting drafted is one thing. I didn't get drafted. I was disappointed in myself. But just because you're drafted, I don't know if a lot of people know this, that doesn't really mean anything. Means something is the contract, right? You want the contract.
Yeah.
And then you're guaranteed, you know, a chance for a couple of years. And that's what I got. Holy cow. I got a contract in front of me. I signed with the Tampa Bay Lightning the same year Steve Stamkos was drafted first overall. And that should have been a moment that I celebrated. And I think my dad was there, and like, he was really celebrating it, but he had no idea what I was up to, you know, off the ice. And I was really struggling with cocaine and everything else. So instead of really taking my pro hockey career, first year of pro hockey, seriously in the summertime, like I should have been. And it's not that I didn't want to. It's just like, I felt like I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop doing these drugs. I just was, it felt so much better than being me. Like, who was I? Like, I hated the way that I felt inside. And it was so scary to even think about telling anybody about that, that it was just, it felt easier just to go and do this. And I wasn't realizing how much of an effect it was having on me. So long story short, Jeff, I went into my first pro season of hockey, and I think I was on the ice maybe four or five times all summer. I even went to the gym three times. And now all of a sudden you go from junior to pro hockey. I wasn't prepared for the difference. But let me tell you, it is a big, big jump, right? Now it's like, of course it's a big jump. But at 20 years old, I think I'm the man. Don't worry, I got this figured out. It can't be that much better. I was in for a rude awakening, let me tell you. And
you froze. You're perfect up to your first game when you did. You're on the ice four times that summer. So just Check your phone. Is there anything popping up or anything? Okay. One second. You're still blurry a bit.
No, I don't know what's.
You're perfectly. You've been perfect. That. You're perfect up to that one time when you're saying about four times on the ice. So wait, you're still blurry. Let's sit.
Give me one sec.
Yeah.
Give me one sec. Jenna, are you on the Wi-Fi? Can you just go on your cellular? Okay, thank you. That could help. That should help. She's off now. He was got up and went on the Wi-Fi. That's why.
Hey, okay.
Sorry about this.
Yeah. No. We'll edit it all out. So get to the point when you're on the when you're on the ice that four times that summer.
Yeah. So leading into my first professional season, I was really struggling mentally and doing a lot of cocaine. I have to be candid. I have to say that. Doesn't even come close to painting the picture of how bad it was really getting, let's just say. And I was barely on the ice all summer, barely in the gym. And this was going to be a big step for me, one that I didn't realize how big it would be. And four games into my professional career that season, I went to go hit a guy like I had probably done thousands of times in my life. But I had put on a little bit of weight over the summer because they told me, "Oh, you should put on about 10-15 pounds because you're going to play pro hockey." The problem was is I put on the weight. My body didn't catch up to it because I didn't do it properly, let's say. Yeah. And so when I went to go hit this guy in the corner, routine hit, like not open ice, nothing big, nothing, just a little rub out in the corner. And my skate, for whatever reason, got caught in the ice and my knee just went pop and it just MCL, ACL, meniscus gone. And it was really the first major injury that I sustained in my whole life, other than concussions and maybe a couple broken bones in my hand that I would just play through that stuff because that, you know, that's what we did back then. But I couldn't keep playing on the knee. And, you know, I was introduced to painkillers, Oxycontin, and that was the answer for me. It felt like, I remember I took that first pill. It was an 80 milligram Oxycontin pill. Like, and it wasn't just like a 5 milligram Percocet or something like that. Like it was the big guy. And I just remember feeling like complete bliss. I can't even describe it. They failed to mention to us, I think, you know, along the way, certainly for me, I was not educated properly on the dangers of drugs and alcohol and mental health and all of that. I think a lot of us, especially at our age, we just didn't talk about that stuff. It was like maybe a couple days in 1 week during the school year that they would talk about drugs, and everyone just took it super long.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, it's like, well, yeah, drugs, but that's never going to be my story. So who cares? Like, I'll never do it. They don't prepare you enough for the choices that you're going to have to make as an adult. And I really kind of walked into that blindly, not 100% blindly, but really naively and kind of maybe cocky. I knew a couple people that had said to me that they were addicted to pills and that they couldn't get off them because of withdrawals. And I'm like, they're just weak. Like, that's not going to happen to me. But more than anything, I love the way that they made me feel. Like, I really, because they don't tell you, painkiller, right? It's a painkiller. Sure, my knee was in pain. Doctor, I'm 21 years old, professional hockey doctor, and just doctor in general, they're professional, hands me some pills. I felt like I was not in a position. Why would I question a doctor?
Yeah.
I was a 21-year-old hockey player. But, you know, now I wish I talk to doctors. I ask questions. I advocate for myself every single time. What is it? I'll get on Google. I'll read it. I'll ask other people, find other people who have taken medications if I'm suggested to take one. But at the time, that's not what I did. And I had no idea that they were also maybe even better for emotional pain, like emotional painkillers. Yeah. So all that trauma, all that pain, all the harassment in minor or junior hockey and all that, anything that I'd gone through that I've been carrying with me for, you know, 16 years at the time, let's say, it felt like I could breathe for the first time in my life. I wasn't riddled with anxiety. I was I felt okay in my own skin. And I had no idea the power of opiates, the power of Oxycontin.
What year was this roughly in? So you're looking at, you're 37, so you're around 15, 16 years ago, give or take.
2008, 2009 would be the time frame. So it would have been late 2008.
Yeah, there is a good 6 to 8 year window when now you hear the stories coming out now in the last 5 years or so, where from pro bodybuilders to wrestlers to pro everybody was getting addicted to that. I mean, it was so heavily used to the point where, I mean, I don't know if you got to that point where they were injecting them into themselves. That was that point of that, where it's got so heavily, and a lot of people died from this. And that is why, I mean, Big Pharma, and I mean, Big Pharma was profiting massive off this. Doctors were pushing this on everyone. Everyone was getting this, whether you're a grandma with a hurt ankle or anybody, everybody, this was being pushed on everyone for a good 8 to 10 year period, right?
Yeah, so they had, if anybody wants to do some more research, I think like the biopic or whatever you call it, Dope Sick, does an incredible job showcasing exactly how it happened. And that's what kind of what happened to me. Like, and the thing is, Jeff, is I really didn't know how physically addicted I was becoming and how quickly. And so at the time I was a new dad, kids, and I was also hanging out with people who were also doing these pills, not because they were prescribed, but because recreationally. And, you know, I could just call the doctor and be like, my gym bag was stolen, or my car was broken into, or I accidentally dropped my pills in the toilet. Like, every excuse there is. No worries, Brady. Don't even have to go see the doctor. Just call him and he'll send it to the pharmacy. And I just go to the pharmacy and pick them up. And so it became, and my tolerance, your tolerance just builds. You start with one and all of a sudden you're doing two. I was doing 15 of them a day by the end.
Oh, wow.
And honestly, out of control. And it was so, it's still hard to go back to the very first time where it's like, you know what, I have a problem with these pills, because I came back from injury and I finished the year and I did very, very well, but I was on these pills, right?
Yeah.
I was heavily addicted to the pills. My knee was better. I was not in any pain for my knee anymore, but they just kept giving me the pills. And then I went home in the summertime and I was like, wow, like, I need to stop these, right? Because it was starting to, it was all I could think about. It was everything. And when I tried to stop for the first time and I went into withdrawal, it was the scariest feeling that I've ever had in my entire life. You can't even explain the misery of withdrawal from opiates. You're puking, you're shitting your pants, you can't sleep for weeks, your whole body hurts. And you know that if you just take a pill or heroin or fentanyl or whatever it is, that guess what? You come back to life and now you function normally.
When you're withdrawing, you're good. But when you were doing the withdrawal or those moments, did you have any family, any support? Were you doing this all on your own? Were people aware that you were trying to clean your system? Like,
no. Again, it was one of those things that I was so embarrassed of, that I was addicted to these pills. And my fiance at the time had a couple of brothers and dad who was also addicted to these pills. And she really hated them, right? Because she had seen what they were doing, and it kind of all happened while I was away playing hockey and came back, and it was just a totally different scene at her family household. And that was the mother of my kids. And she always said, like, if you ever become addicted to these, I'll leave you, I'll do this. And so for a while I hid it from her, until, I'll be honest with you, nobody really knows this, I'm writing a book right now, but the very first time I told her, she was the first person that really knew, other than the few people that I was running around with who were also addicted to them on this super down low, if you will. But when I told her, I was like, look, I'm addicted to Oxycontin, and I had actually had it set up where I was going to go to detox and go to a place to get better. And I said, I have to leave because this is what's going on. I can't stop here. I said, because your brothers are doing them. Even if I don't have my script, your brothers are giving them to me. Your dad's doing them. Like, it was just like a very convoluted story. But when I asked for help for the first time, she slapped me across the face and canceled our wedding. And so that was my first experience of asking for help. And you know, I ended up going to detox and stayed for a few days, but that was at 22 years old. By 23, I was smoking heroin because the pills. So again, that's like, how does somebody go from a prescription medication to heroin, Jeff?
Yeah.
Let me tell you. They changed the makeup of the pills and they changed the way that they dispense the pills. First off, I got cut off my prescription. My dad found out eventually, like, because my ex called him and the mom. So her mom and my dad actually took me into my family doctor's office and was like, you got to get, my dad was like, you got to get Brady off these pills. My doctor, first of all, was beside himself. Like, what the hell? He's like, why are you on this high of a dose? Like, why are you even on this medication? Because he was one of the ones that could actually see through it. Yeah. He didn't prescribe that stuff like everybody else was, right? But my dad was like, you just got to cut him off. Just cut him off and that will fix the problem. And so that's what they did, not knowing that, okay, well, I'm just going to go to the streets to find them. And I did, was able to find, I ended up breaking up with my ex and got disconnected from her brothers and those sources and all that kind of stuff. So I had to go somewhere else to find them, let's say. And there's this one guy that I found that was super reliable for about a year. And every day, almost every day or two, I would go see him. And I was spending thousands of dollars on these pills. They weren't cheap. I would go see him. And every time I would go see him, I would get in his car and he'd be smoking heroin off tinfoil. And he'd always ask me. And I was like, man, are you kidding me? Like, no. Just like the music festival, like when someone showed me the pill, I'm like, no. Because in my mind, what I was doing, these pills were coming from a pharmacy. Even though I was getting them illegally on the street, at some point in time, a doctor was prescribing them and they were coming through a medical pharmacy and then to the street. I didn't, or at least I wasn't willing to acknowledge that basically I was already doing heroin, the same chemical makeup for my body. And he always asked me, he's like, you want to do it? And I'm like, no. So one day I went to go meet him, Jeff. And he's like, Brady, I don't know. They stopped dispensing the pills. They changed the makeup of them. They're really hard to get. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to get them like I used to be able to get them. And I was in withdrawal. I was in terrible withdrawal. I think it was second day of no pill. And he looked at me and he had foil in his hand and he had a little flap with heroin in it. And he's like, you want to feel better? Just try this. And in that moment, I always tell everybody I would have eaten dog shit if I knew that would make me feel better, because that's how much pain I was in physically. From the withdrawal. And so I grabbed that foil, had really no idea what I was doing, but I had watched him do it enough times and I did it. And that was it. I mean, I made the switch like that, like in an instant. I actually found out that heroin was easier to find, but then all of a sudden I was meeting more marginalized people. I was in more marginalized places. Next thing you know, I was smoking crack. I was smoking heroin and, you know, didn't take me long for me to become an IV drug user. I think that started in 2012. I shot up for the first time. You know, there was many times from 2009 to 2013 that I was in detoxes, rehabs, psych wards from suicide attempts. I was in the psych ward for a year. 6 months was the longest I was in there at once, and then 3 months, and then 3 months. I went to 6 or 7 rehabs. I went to detox 10 or 11 times. And, you know, I legitimately at the beginning was trying to get my life back. I would go into rehab and I would talk the talk and I would do everything that was suggested. I would do everything except for one thing. And that was talk about what happened to me as a kid. That was something that I put on the shelf and I thought to myself, I'm willing to look at my life and, you know, take accountability and do the things, but we are not going there. We cannot go back to the sexual abuse. It was too painful. It was just off limits. And so I would do okay at first. I would do, I think the longest I went was 7 months. Obviously, I wasn't playing hockey anymore. I lost everything. I lost my family, lost my hockey career. I did end up going to rehab for the first time and then staying there for 11 or 12 weeks. And my dad picked me up at rehab, took me to the airport. I hadn't played hockey in a year and a half. And I went and played in like the two levels below the NHL. I went from rehab there and did really well. And actually got an opportunity to move up to the American Hockey League the next year. But I came home. I was on the flight and I was flying into Vancouver from Texas where I was playing. And I had nothing set up. I was 7 or 8 months clean, but I was playing hockey prior to. I left rehab, went to play hockey. They were drug testing me and it was like that focus. I knew that as soon as I flew in Vancouver, I just looked down at the city and I'm like, I'm done. Like I know I could feel it. Like I could just feel like my life was going to fall apart again. And that was in 2012. And then, so I went, you know, I tried to go back to rehab. I ended up getting kicked out for using while I was in there. And then I started shooting up. And by 2014, I was, after all the rehabs and detox, I gave up on that. I was like, I've done this so many times. It's not working. I was blaming, you know, the rehab doesn't work. This doesn't work. What the reason why it didn't work is because I wasn't doing the work. I did 95%, but that 5% that I left out was really like the 95% that I had to do. And all the rest of the work was like the 5%.
Yeah.
But in my mind, it was misconstrued. And, you know, I'd really given up. I was so low. I took and took and took and did every piece of shit thing that you could think of that addicts do first to your friends and your family until there's nothing left to take and they want nothing to do with you because you're destroying their lives as well. I ended up homeless on the streets of Vancouver, downtown East Side, Hastings Street in Vancouver, which is,
yeah,
there's no other place like it in Canada. I think we're trending towards that, sadly. There's a lot of places now. Even where close to me in Orillia and Barrie, and certainly in Toronto, we're seeing homeless populations spike like crazy. But Hastings Street in Vancouver has been notorious for 50 years plus, like long before I was born. Yeah. And my dad used to take me to Canuck games as a kid, and we'd drive through there, and I'd make sure the doors were locked because it was scary. And I'm like, my dad's like, if you do drugs, if you don't go to school, this is where you end up. I remember him saying that to me all the time. In one case, actually, a really profound story, if we have a few minutes, it's just one of these things. When you look back at your life, I truly believe that there are divine attempts at intervention, if you will, yeah, where if you just were able to pay attention, then you could make some better decisions. Well, I was 18 years old. I was with my friend, and I'm from Port Coquitlam, which is about 25, 30 minutes east of Vancouver. And we were going to go down to, I was like, let's go downtown Vancouver. Let's go to Canada Place. Let's go down to the ocean and probably go check out girls or whatever the hell we were doing at 18 years old. And we did that. And then on the way home, it was starting to get dark. It was probably about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And I was like, to my buddy Anthony, I was like, let's go down to Hastings Street. Like, let's go drive through the back alleys and like look at all the drug addicts and look at all the prostitutes and look at all the carnage and just like pretty much let's go down there and judge these people. Like I was 18 years old. That's what that was. Like, let's go check it out. And so I was driving and I turned into this alley, right in the thick of it, of the downtown East Side. And right away I got pulled over. Like right away I got pulled over. And if anybody, I don't know about you guys, if you're watching or Jeff, if you get pulled over, it's not a very good feeling, right?
Like, yeah.
The butterflies and your anxiety, stomach. Even if you're not doing anything wrong.
The anxiety, right? You're just driving and a cop's behind you and you've done nothing wrong. You slow down and you build the anxiety. Yeah. Like, oh, fuck, I don't want to be pulled over.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just remember, but I was thinking, like, I had my hockey bag in the back of my pickup. I had a canopy, an old Ford Ranger. And I was like, I wasn't doing anything wrong. But this guy, the cop comes to the window. And he put his flashlight right in the window, right in my face. He's like, what are you guys looking for? Drugs or a date? And I'm like, what? I didn't even know what he meant, right? I was 18. I was like, but super cocky, like super cocky. I was like, neither, sir. I play in the Western Hockey League. We're just I had to check things out. I got my hockey bag in the back. We're really sorry. We were just coming down here. We don't do drugs. We don't even, you know, start to dabble, whatever, giving my 2 cents speech, whatever, thinking that maybe he's a hockey fan. Maybe he's going to like the WHL. Because I don't agree with it, but I got preferential treatment up to that point in my life.
Wait, hold one sec. You totally froze there. You totally froze again. You have to go back. Wait, unfreeze. No, it's okay. We'll edit these out, man. No, we'll edit. This is not an issue. I mean, it was good right to it. Then you just completely froze right to the part when the cop went to the window and started banging with the light. So just, yeah. Okay. One sec. Wait, check your that. Yeah, check your phone again because you're totally frozen.
I think, well, there we go. Let's try that. Give it a sec to kick in. It should be good to go here.
Give me one sec. Wait, I'll tell you when it's good. There you go. Okay, you're better now.
Perfect. Yeah, so, got pulled over. I'm sitting in the car, butterflies in my stomach, and the cop comes to the window, and he's got his flashlight right in my face, like inches from my face. What are you guys looking for, drugs or a date? And I can't even tell you how confused I was because I did not know what he meant. I was like, I knew what drugs were. I'm like, but what? Like, I'm not down here for that reason. I'm like super cocky, tons of ego. I'm like, neither, sir. I play in the Western Hockey League. We're just down here to check things out and you know, we'll be on our way. My hockey bag's in the back. I promise we're not down here to do any of that stuff. We're sorry for being down here. And he went and he shined his light in the back of my truck and my hockey bag was back there. And in my mind for a second, I'm thinking like, okay, like one, we're not doing anything wrong. Two, good chance he's going to be a hockey fan and whatever, right? Like that was kind of the treatment that I had been accustomed to, which is not right, but it was just the truth. And he came back to the window and I could see his face change. He went from being like, kind of pissed off to real pissed off real quick. And it was kind of confusing, but it all happened really quick. And he came even closer. I felt like the flashlight was in his breath, like right in my face, like centimeters away. And I'll never forget it, Jeff. He leaned in real close and he said, you think because you're some fucking hockey player, you're above any of this stuff down here? He goes, there's a former pro hockey player down here right now that's missing an arm because he became an IV drug user. He's like, if you come down here, you stay down here. And 18-year-old Brady looked back at this police officer and said, that will never be me, right? And nothing happened that night, right? But there was that moment where it was like, do not come down here. You fast forward, not even 10 years later, there I am, homeless on the downtown east side. And it wasn't like, oh, I was on the street for a night or for a week or for a month. I was down there for close to a year. And the only reason that I got out of there alive is because I got arrested. I never thought I would be homeless. I never thought I'd be homeless on the downtown east side. I never thought I'd be a drug addict. But jail? No way. Like I'm a really good human being when I'm not on the drugs. Like I don't feel, I don't lie. I don't, never really did. Right. I mean, I lied about my feelings and stuff, but I mean, like I'm really genuinely a good person. Like going to jail was so far from reality. In fact, they opened the jail. I was telling my girlfriend this the other day, cause I'm writing my book and I wrote this in there, is that they actually built that jail, the new jail where everybody from Vancouver at pre-trial goes to, just minutes from my childhood home when I was growing up. And I remember being so scared of that place, thinking they're going to escape. They're going to come through the back bush. Like I was terrified of Crime Stoppers. I was scared of America's Most Wanted, right? That music would come on or you'd see that face and I'd be like, oh my God, like they're coming for me or whatever. Now all of a sudden, I'm homeless on the downtown east side. I got no real friends. My family doesn't talk to me because they I'd give them no choice. I mean, my mom would periodically pop in with food and water, find me homeless. I know my dad looked for me at different times, but was never able to find me. He was paying people on the street $5, $10. Hey, where do you know my son? Have you seen him? All this stuff. I mean, I started to overdose a lot. I overdosed more times than I can count. Many times waking up in the hospital, the heart rate monitors and my parents there. And sometimes just, you know, naloxone by another addict who's on the street. Like, I'm very lucky to be alive. But while I was down there, I mean, I had no money. I didn't have a job. I had no outside support. I had burned every bridge in my life. And, well, how do you survive? Like, how do you keep the addiction going? You start to steal, you start to do crime. I did anything and everything, Jeff, from going into stores and stealing colognes and perfumes to liquor stores, filling up carts with all the high-end liquors and crashing out of there into a stolen car and peeling off to violent robberies, to break and enters into residential and commercial buildings. I mean, selling drugs on the street. I did anything that I could do to keep the addiction going. And at that point, I mean, I didn't really care what happened. I went from zero to like 150 real quick. I went from having no criminal record, never doing a crime in my life, to like a 5 or 6 month crime spree across Vancouver and the Lower Mainland and the surrounding cities, stealing cars and doing all the things, because you start to hang out with people that are doing that, and yeah, you get taught different things. And I mean, it was what I felt like I had to do to survive. I'm certainly not proud of all those things. It took a while for the cops to catch up with me because they didn't know who I was, right? I didn't have a record. Who is this 27, 28 year old guy with no history of criminal activity? They had a really hard time getting me.
Yeah.
And then even when I would get caught, because I had no criminal record, they didn't really have any grounds to hold me until like the next court date. So that's usually like months away. So they give me a promise to appear. And I would use fake names and get out. And then finally because I would know my friends' birthdays and their mom's maiden names and all this stuff. And I actually got my first couple of my friends in trouble who were not criminals, right? Because they get pulled over and now they got warrants. And these guys, they still don't talk to me. Some of my best childhood friends, I feel like a complete piece of shit for it. But again, in that desperation, I needed to keep going. I needed to keep feeding my body these drugs, which primarily at the time was fentanyl and crystal meth. I mean, I started seeking out fentanyl in 2013 in Vancouver that might sound crazy to people. So what you have to understand is that, yes, fentanyl is, they always say, is it 10 times, is it 100 times, is it 1,000 times stronger than heroin? I don't know. It depends on which one you're getting, I guess, the different versions. But yes, they're stronger in a sense that it can stop your heart and stop your breathing like that. And it's just stronger in general. But what a lot of people don't know is that your tolerance for opiates builds up very quickly. I kind of hit on it earlier where it started with one pill and ended it with 15. Well, there was this one dealer that I started seeing in Vancouver about 2012, 2013, sorry, in my town of Coquitlam. I was just saying Vancouver because I'm in Ontario. Yeah. It's easier to say Vancouver. But all of a sudden it was like, it wasn't heroin. It was quite a bit stronger. And I realized that, you know, and talked to the guys and realized that they started to bring in fentanyl. And because I had only gone to them for 4, 5, 6 months in a row and only taken that stuff, if I would go get the most high-grade heroin,
it would do nothing.
Anywhere else, it would do nothing. I would still be sick. So I had to seek out different, you know, fentanyl. And then eventually by 2014, there was like no heroin around. It all became fentanyl and lost a lot of friends. I don't want to say I should have, but I could have died so many times. And just to put things into perspective, when you talk about the power of addiction, the power of fentanyl, and I did it myself, and I've seen even more people do it, where somebody is overdosed. And like I've used naloxone well over 50 times on people, like through my years of addiction in different places, being in, you know,
Yeah.
Again, to paint the picture is tough. It was a lot of years at a lot of different places and super grateful for it. But for naloxone, because it kept me alive and kept a lot of my friends alive when I was able to be there and administer it. But to paint the picture, the power of addiction is this. A group of addicts addicted to fentanyl or heroin, whatever it was, they see somebody overdose, right? They don't think, oh no, that person overdosed. That's scary. It's like more like, where did he or she get that stuff? Because I want that. I've seen people go through people's pockets who were overdosing to get the strong stuff out of their pockets while somebody's naloxoning them, or even in one case, and listen, I did that. You know, I knocked on somebody and I'm like, I want that strong stuff. Or people are like, wake that person up. We need to know where they got that stuff. Like, where are they getting that stuff that strong? So to understand it, like, people have to realize that, like, it's not a tainted drug supply. Does that happen? You're absolutely right, it does. Is there some cross-contamination and do they lace things? I don't know how much of that goes on, but yes, it's happened. But primarily, people are seeking fentanyl and the most powerful stuff because you never think that it's going to kill you.
As an outsider, something that's not involved in that world, you're just hearing what the media is saying right now, and fentanyl is out of control right now.
Yeah,
it's out of control, and all you hear is the amount of deaths are increasing, the amount of overdoses is increasing, the amount of people addicted is increasing. I've been hearing this for the last maybe 3 to 4 years. You're talking on this is quite a 10, 12 year period of this. So this has been ongoing for a while.
Especially in Vancouver, right? Vancouver was sort of ground zero for the fentanyl epidemic to start, certainly in Canada.
Yeah.
I think because it's a port city, this is like Montreal too, right?
I was going to say Montreal. Yeah. The two port cities. There was a TV show on the Italian mob in Montreal. Yeah. Did you watch that?
The guy from Sons of Anarchy.
Yes. Actually, apparently they're going to do a runoff of it of just him. But they're that's when they were talking about how fentanyl entered the ports and all that stuff like that and all that stuff. Yeah, which is crazy, right?
Yeah. And here I just want to share something with people because it's hard to understand. Okay, like how is this coming in? Where is it coming in? So I'll tell you a big reason why. And this is maybe not, this is off topic of my story, but since we're talking about fentanyl addiction, and I hope that people can have this gives people a little bit of an understanding of like what's going on. Because I mean, I was in that life, I was running with some pretty, while I was in jail, and we'll talk about that a little bit, while I was on the street, while I was doing whatever, people always treated me a little bit differently because I was a professional hockey player, right? Like it was weird that I was able to get into some of the inner circles of like really quickly where you get to see and hear things and do things. But one of the problems that they're having with fentanyl and the reason why it took over is you have to think about, okay, where did heroin come from? Primarily Afghanistan, Turkey, these places over there. Okay. So it comes usually in 1 kilogram packages. Like we all see on the news when they're being busted, whether it's cocaine or heroin, like it's a brick like this. Okay. So you can take a small amount of fentanyl and its analogs like this and turn it into hundreds of those. So instead of having to bring in 1 kilogram at a time, you can, and they bring in lots of the stuff, but then they can make from this amount, they can make, you know, the room full of this amount, because that's how potent it is. So that's why they started to do it, because it just became easier to transport. It became more profitable. Yeah. And another thing is like, well, why can't they stop it? Well, what's happening a lot, and again, you can read this, and there's a lot of it started and originated in China, comes over from China is what they're saying.
Yeah.
So what they have been doing, certainly in Vancouver, is it's run by a lot of Asian gangs, the triads, these types of gangs. And what they do, and I know this too, because I have friends who are and were very high ranking law enforcement. Now with everything that I'm doing, I'm like tied into, I have cops and stuff who are supporting me. We have foundations. And so we always talk about like, I'm like, so what from the policing side, what, like, why can't we stop this? Right. And I had a staff sergeant from the OPP, major crimes, who was in like the head of the whole major crimes and the whole thing in Eastern Ontario. And she told me, she goes, we can't stop it, because what they do is they'll bring in people from other countries, let's say China, for example, on fake passports, and they'll come here for 2 weeks. They'll fly in, they'll rent like a U-Haul cube van, like big truck. They'll park, and these people they're flying in are chemists, right? Like chemists, and they bring them in, and they'll go park like a U-Haul truck in like an IKEA parking lot, a mall parking lot, or wherever. And this chemist will be in the back of that truck, unbeknownst to anybody else, making fentanyl all day for a week at a time or whatever.
Breaking Bad happening in real life.
Exactly. And moving at different spots every day. And by the time the police or, you know, or the CIA or the FBI anywhere, even in the States, they find it, the people are gone. They're on fake passports. They're back in China. The whole operation is moved. And they're like, this is what she told me. And, you know, I saw a little bit of that. I wasn't like so up there, but it's kind of scary. And so to my point is like, that's why we have to have these conversations, and more needs to be done about educating certainly our youth and the adults, and supporting those who are in the trenches right now, who are in addiction, who are struggling with mental health, because not enough support is out there, but from like the government and funding and all of that. But like, that's a high hope, Jeff. Like, we at the end of the day have so much more power when we focus on people helping people. Like, do we need those outside supports, and do we need lots of money and treatment centers and all those things? Yeah, like that's without question. But we all as people,
community.
Community. That's what it comes down to. And showing people that it can be done, that you can get out of it, that you know you can recover.
Let's lead that into your redemption story. Sorry. I mean, no, don't use it. Sorry. I mean, this is such a crazy story, and we could talk about all day about the drugs and everything you've been through, but I think the most powerful aspect of the story is your redemption story and where you are now. And then eventually I want to get into your event, but when was that switch? When was that switch? Yeah. And how did you, was there people that helped you with the switch, or was it something that you just locked in your head? Like, I need to get this done for myself. Like, when was that switch?
Yeah. I'll try to keep this short, but I didn't really mention, I was telling you guys about the jail in my hometown and all that kind of stuff, and I was scared of it. And, I was on this crime spree. Well, pretty soon my face, they found out who I was.
Yeah.
And pretty soon I was on the face. I was the most wanted in the Vancouver area on Crime Stoppers. I was on that commercial, you know, like more than once. I was in the newspaper more than once. Crime Stoppers wanted for everybody to see, my family, my friends growing up. It was on the news. And eventually they got me, right? I spent 2 years in jail when it caught up with me for the first time. I wish I could say I went in there and got my life back together, but it was just, you go in with a bachelor, you leave with a master's in crime, because you're just hanging out with people all day. There's not a whole lot of correcting. They call it corrections. They don't call it a whole lot. They just don't have the resources in there.
Yeah.
And that was a common misconception, at least for me. I was like, corrections, well, they must have programs. They must have, and in the federal system, they kind of do, but vast majority, they don't give you anything. And so what happened was, is I went to jail for 2 years, and I came out, and I ended up going to that same jail in my hometown for 6 months, which was crazy because it was right by my hometown. I ended up there, right? And then got transferred to another one to finish my sentence. And then I got out, and within, I don't know, my mom picked me up, and within the amount of time it took me to get on the SkyTrain in Vancouver, it's like the subway, and to get down to Hastings was like 2 hours. I was like right from my mom's in Coquitlam, right back down to Hastings, and right had a needle in my arm, like right away. I overdosed 4 times in a 3-day period. The final time I did it on my mom's front lawn back in Coquitlam after I came back from Hastings. So I was staying with my mom when I got out of jail. She didn't want me there, but I had nowhere else to go, and they didn't want me on the street again, but I wasn't listening or following rules. And I ended up overdosing on her front lawn. And interestingly enough, I just got a message from one of the police officers that attended the scene just a couple weeks ago. And she's like, "Brady, I can't believe I found you. How well you're doing." She goes, "I came to a call in Coquitlam to an unresponsive male. And, you know, you were out of it. We were able to, you know, get you back. And you know, I'm so proud of you seeing what you're doing today." But that was sort of the moment where my dad was like, "Hey, you got to get out of Vancouver." He put me on a plane to Ontario. I was seeing a girl in Ontario at the time who had moved to Ontario while I was in jail. And so I came, followed her kind of out here. And my addiction and all my problems followed me. You can't outrun them. I ended up in jail in Ontario for a year. I got in a high-speed chase away from the police in a stolen vehicle and ended up crashing in which was a suicide attempt at the end. Yeah. Because I was running out of gas and nowhere to go. I didn't want to go back to jail. I didn't want my name to be in the newspapers again, because when I got sentenced, it was front page news. Ex-former pro hockey player sentenced to jail. I was like, my dad can't see that again. Like, I'm done. So I crashed into this median going at like 150 kilometers an hour. And obviously it didn't work. Luckily, I'm still here.
Talk about nine lives.
Yeah, you're telling me. And so I ended up getting arrested. I spent 11 months. I always just say a year because it's either 11 months behind bars in Ontario. And when I got out, you know, I had not been on skates in 9 years. I couldn't even watch hockey, man. My friends were still playing in the NHL. Guys would watch it on the TV in jail. They're like, "Come on, don't you want to watch hockey?" I'm like, "No, like I'm going to look this way because I had more points than that guy. I fought that guy and beat that guy up," or whatever. Like, you know, it wasn't like everybody. Like, most players in the league were better than me, but there was the odd guy where it was like, I could have been there. Well, I got out, and for the first 2 months, I really struggled, much like I had been for the years previous. Until I knew I was going to be a dad again. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter named Veda. And so, you know, I didn't talk about a lot here today, but you know, they're my two kids out in BC, they didn't have a dad, because of my addiction. And there's a lot that goes into that, but unfortunately it wasn't a part of their life for many years. Once they turned 6 and 7, I didn't see them, and now they're 14 and 15, and I haven't seen them since then. I do talk to my son a little bit, but it weighed heavily on me, right? Throughout those years, still does. And I knew that I was going to be a dad again, and I knew that I had to do something. I was like, I can't let this happen again. And so what happened was I was in Muskoka. I was at a different place, but I was in the middle of nowhere, a place called Utterson up here in Muskoka. And, you know, had an ATV, where I was staying, there was an ATV and there was just tons of trails, and it was in the middle of nowhere. I didn't have a license. I didn't have a car. I couldn't drive. I mean, I could have stolen one like I had done so many times, but I wanted to make a change. And, the Swift Current Broncos, where I played 4 years, my junior, actually sent me a pair of skates, prior when I got out of jail the first time. And they ended up in a pawn shop. Somebody pawned them in Orillia. And I actually went to the pawn shop and found them. They were like $1,400 skates, and they were in the window for $70. You know what I mean? Like, with custom, with my name on the box, like custom everything. And I got them out of the pawn shop and I put them on. It was about the end of February of 2020. And I just put on my skates and I skated on an outdoor lake here in Muskoka. No stick, no nothing. I'd never felt so free in my whole entire life. At the time, I was 2 weeks. I was 2 weeks clean when I put my skates on. And something came over me where it was like, you know what? I need to start a podcast. I'm going to start a podcast. I'm going to start sharing my story. But if I'm going to share my story, I have to share it in its entirety. And I have to get brutally honest. And part of that was telling my dad, telling my mom, telling people that were close to me that I was sexually abused. And I started to get some therapy. I reached out to guys like Theo Fleury and Sheldon Kennedy, Todd Holt, who were hockey players and had gone through something similar, not exactly, but who had been voices and over the years had shown me. It took a long time, but I always watched their stuff. I read Theo's book like 10 times. I watched his documentary 10 times. It's like, if he can, you know, have the strength to overcome these demons and he can share his truth, then maybe I can too. And so I took those steps. I started a podcast. I was on welfare. I literally had nothing, like zero, and borrowed a computer. I sat in I asked someone to borrow their car. I was like, I promise I won't steal it. I just need to use it as a podcast studio for like an hour. And I sat in the car and recorded the first episode of what was called Hockey to Heroin, The Road to Recovery. It's now called Hockey to Hell and Back. It's a little bit more user friendly.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of big name hockey players on the show, and I was really lucky early on to get Sheldon and Theo, and you know, Doug Gilmore came on, and that was sort of like, Doug Gilmore has become a friend. He's been on a bunch. And I remember I posted a picture. I had no social media, nothing when I started, right? Like I just, yeah. That life of addiction. I didn't talk to anybody. Any social media I had, fake name, right? Not really me. It was me, but under a fake name. I saw a picture where it said Hockey to Heroin, The Road to Recovery, episode, whatever it was, Doug Gilmore. And I was like, that doesn't look so good. Hockey to Heroin, like Dougie's pretty squeaky clean. I was like, Hockey to Hell and Back. I think that, you know, someone helped me with the name and that just resonates with more people. And so that's what it's called. But what happened was, a few things have happened over the last 3 years. Obviously, one, I've done a lot of work on myself. I didn't go to rehab this time. I've learned a lot over the years of going to meetings and going to rehab all those years. And I have a lot of great tools in my tool belt that I still use from those places, but wasn't a part of my story this time around. It really just started with me on the podcast and me doing live videos on Facebook. You know, 25 views or whatever it was getting to start.
Yeah.
And just started spamming my podcast to Facebook with the creepy algorithm. People you may know, every picture just seemed like after a while it was a hockey player or somebody, hockey logos. I'm like, ad, blasted off. And pretty soon Sportsnet picked up the story. Sports Illustrated picked up the story. People started to listen. And more than anything, I started to get messages of primarily hockey players. Now it's anybody and everybody, but messages of people sharing their stories with me, oftentimes saying like, hey, I've never told anybody this before, but X, Y, and Z, thank you for, you know, what you're doing and that kind of stuff, which obviously gave me purpose. It made me, number one, not feel alone, but gave me a sense of purpose where it was like, hey, like I can help people. My story can help people. I started to What really kicked me into high gear was uncovering stories of hockey players specifically who had passed away to suicide or overdose.
There's been quite a few.
To my knowledge right now, I'm aware of 103, and that's ranging from 14-year-old girl hockey players up to NHL players. And I bet you there's another 500 that I haven't heard about. But what happened is Sportsnet did a story. And I shared, if people can go back and read it, it's still there. But I share a story about being at Tampa Bay Lightning development camp and really stressed out because I hadn't skated, kind of like I told you here. And Stamkos was there. And the night before it's about to start, I was a mess. Like walking around the hotel, like, I need to get out of here. I need to leave. Like, I'm going to make a fool of myself. But I ran into this guy, and his name is Mitch Fadden. And Mitch was a guy I played against my whole life, minor hockey and in the WHL. He was drafted by Tampa, arguably the most talented hockey player that I ever played with or saw. Like, he was just that good. I didn't know that he had a story similar to mine and that he had struggled. And so I ran into him in the hotel lobby that night. I left his name out in the Sportsnet story. I didn't say his name because it wasn't my business to air out. But I did tell the story. And then the next day, or sorry, that night, we ended up staying up all night, having some drinks and actually doing coke instead of like sleeping like everybody else and getting ready for a camp to start the next day. We had an exhibition game in the morning, an inter-squad game, which me and Mitch and Stamko started on the first line of forwards. We were up all night doing this. And I just remember looking at him like, Mitch, like, what the hell were we doing? You fast forward, we ended up living together for a short period of time down in the American Hockey League and all that. And we became really close. But I shared this story in Sportsnet. Then the story came out. And I hadn't talked to Mitch since 2017. I'd talked to him sporadically over my years of addiction because I knew he had been struggling and then he was better. And the last time I talked to him, he's like, yeah, I'm working in the oil fields. Hurt his back. He couldn't play hockey anymore. He's like, but I'm clean. I'm doing really well. So Sportsnet drops the story. And I'm reading it and I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, this story is wild. Like, what were we thinking? Like the night before playing with Stamkos. I'm like, I got to find Mitch. Like, I got to... you know, because the name was left out. Like I said, I hadn't talked to him in many years. I'm like, we got to talk. He should come on my podcast. His story could help people. Like, I couldn't find him. And interestingly enough, I put a post on Facebook at the time. I said, does anybody know where Mitch Fadden is? And you talk about Justin Bryan, who connected us.
Yeah.
He's actually friends with Mitch's brother, Matt. And I ended up getting a message from Justin, who I didn't know at the time. And he said, hey, what's your phone number? I want to give you a call. And so I gave him my number, and he goes, and I answered the phone. He goes, hey, Brady, my name's Justin Bryan. I know you're looking for Mitch Fadden. He goes, I don't want to have to be the one to tell you this. He goes, but Mitch passed away of a fentanyl overdose in 2017.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. And I literally collapsed to the floor. I was just like, I couldn't believe it. Because at that time, he was only the second player that I knew had passed away from fentanyl overdose. I had heard of one other OHL hockey player. And I was just really narrowing in on the hockey community. How can I make an impact in hockey, number one? That's where I was. I've since broadened it, but this was 2020. And I wanted to do something. I was like, my story is one story. How many other stories are out there of people who have passed away? How many other guys are struggling? How many other girls are struggling who have pursued this life of hockey and it didn't work out? And now they're really struggling with mental health or addiction. And so I started to really uncover these stories, and it just keeps going one after the other. And so I really wanted to do something to make an impact. And I wanted to start a foundation to really help support hockey players with mental health and addiction. And I was calling lawyers, and they would tell me, you know, it's going to be about $10,000 to start a charity. And I'm like, I don't even have $10. The only shoes I had were jail-issued shoes. I'm borrowing a computer to do this podcast. And I had no teeth because I lost them playing hockey. Like, I didn't have fake ones at the time. I was doing everything. I looked like hell. I could show you a video. I looked awful. And a lot of people were supportive, but I think a lot of people were also on the fence. But I didn't know what to do, and I didn't have the money. And actually, Doug Gilmore, his older brother, did a fundraiser in Kingston on his 70th birthday. He ran 20K and rode his bike 50K and raised like $3,000 and sent it to me, which was a big deal. I mean, I was 6 months into my recovery. It was a significant amount of money for me. And I could have done anything. I could have went off in my addiction. I could have taken that and done whatever, but I wanted to do something to move the mission forward.
Yeah.
And it wasn't enough to incorporate the charity, but I got an idea, like, what can I do? Maybe I can make a professional video and honor all the hockey players that we've lost and kind of make a business plan on what we can do to really make an impact. But then what? Like, if I spent all the money and I don't have anything, the videos prepared, give somebody the idea and then they take it, which at the end of the day, I wouldn't care as long as people are getting support. But I decided, you know what? Maybe I could start a clothing line, right? I have still 3 years later, I have no idea what I'm doing. But I bought a heat press. I bought a vinyl cutter with the money.
Yeah.
I was able to start an e-commerce, and I built the website myself. It's still not very good. But I learned how to do it all on YouTube. I spent hours and hours and hours learning how to do this and practicing. I designed our logo. I, you know, created the slogans, like mental health over hockey. This one, you know, is one of ours where the puck support logo is here. It says one day at a time. But what the most important thing for me with the clothing line was, I was just like, what can I do in the meantime to get the message out there? Because you wear a shirt and do a hockey ring that says mental health over hockey, or it's okay to be not okay, or puck addiction, or puck the stigma, or any of those. It creates these conversations, and the feedback we've gotten over the last 2 years is just incredible. But the most important thing that for me is that we put a name of one of those 103 hockey players in all of our stuff. So you flip up a sweater, and there'll be a name of a hockey player and a way to remember them. I don't have one of our hats on, but in our hats, it would be here. And like I said, the database is sadly growing continually. It was 2, it was 5, it was 14, it was 40, now it's 103. And I've just become that guy where if something like that happens, it's coming to my inbox now. And like a lot of the families who have lost their sons or daughters or husbands. And it's to suicide or overdose, right?
Yeah.
If they've lost their lives, and they wear it. The name actually in the sweater is Daniel Miner, played for the Barry Colts in the OHL. He died of a fentanyl overdose in 2021. Similar story, got hurt, got prescribed painkillers. I never met him. I never got the chance to meet him because he was from Ontario. I was in BC, but his family has become like family to me. I've gone down and stayed at their house like four or five different times. They've come up here. They all like support Puck Support, like a lot of the families. We have thousands of people wearing it now all across North America. But I got on the first Mother's Day. So it was like March. It's 2 months after Daniel passed away. I got a message from his mom, Michelle. And it was a picture of all their family together for their Mother's Day dinner. And they're all wearing Puck Support. And she said in the message, she said, you know, here's a picture of our family. This is my first Mother's Day without my son, without Daniel. She goes, we can never bring him back, but I want to say thank you for honoring him, for remembering him and doing this, because we're all wearing Puck Support with his name. They all had Daniel Minor, just like I do, in their sweaters. And it's like, it feels like a piece of them is here with us. And, you know, we've had a lot of different families who have lost loved ones, feel the same, and also gives them support, to know that they're not alone, that, you know, trying to connect families who have gone through tragedies, to help support them, because until you've lived something, I truly don't believe you really know what it's like. And I think people with lived experience have so much more to bring to the table than what they've been given credit for or even opportunities for. Lived experience is so important, right? It's so important. And so, you know, that's what I did 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, started the Clothing Line. I was doing the podcast. Literally was on welfare up until a few months ago, I think 7 or 8 months ago. I took everything really slow. 2.5 years ago, I went to a goalie camp. My buddy from that played in the WHL too ended up, I found out we were friends growing up. I found out he's in Ontario and he runs a very successful goalie camp. He's like, hey, you want to come work at one of my goalie camps? Like, maybe you can give a little speech to the kids. Maybe kids come out. Again, I had no teeth. I was skinny. I looked like hell. I was 6-7 months into recovery. And I had zero confidence. I had zero belief that any parents would want me around, that anybody would in the hockey, that I'm out of the hockey community. I could share my story, but I'm not getting near the hockey community. Like, I'm just not. Like, I'm not getting around kids. I'm not getting, because of my criminal history and all those things. It's very public. Plus now I'm talking about it all the time. But I went out there and the kids were drawn to me right away. The parents were like, this is incredible. And slowly started to build my confidence by doing these goalie camps. I'm not a goalie. I'm a right winger.
Yeah.
Till finally I got the confidence to be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to do something small on my own and start coaching a little bit. And I really started to do that, I would say last summer, where it was like a regular thing. And, you know, started a separate social media for my hockey training and started to work with some AAA players, some junior players. And, you know, because I still have a lot of knowledge and for whatever reason, I was able to retain a lot of my skill, especially stick handling. I'm old and slow, but I because of my ability, like all those years I spent stick handling, my hands, my stick handling was always my best attribute. Like, and nowadays it's all over social media. Kids are doing these tricks and everything else. And I was doing that before Instagram was even a thing. Right. So yeah. I was sort of that, you know, so I could do that. So it's kind of relevant to the kids. So it's provided this really unique opportunity where I can be a mentor. I can coach and I can, you know, and I can speak to these kids. And last summer, I think it was August, I don't want to say August 1st, just about a year ago, I got a message in my inbox on my Instagram from a guy named Sam Gagne, who just recently this past NHL season played in his 1,000th game in the NHL.
Of course, Sam Gagne.
Right. Pretty, like, I never knew him. He was an OHL guy. I was a WHL guy. But, you know, all these guys, they got cottages in Muskoka. So where are they all summer? They're training in Muskoka. Sam messaged me. I wasn't even following him or anything. I was always reluctant to even follow NHL players because they're going to be like thinking like I'm some loser, that drug addict, that, you know what I mean? All the judgments that I was fearful of. Guess what? He started following me, sent me a message. He goes, hey, Brady, I've been following you for a while, even though I haven't been following you. He's like, I've been watching your stuff. He goes, I love what you're doing. Thank you for being a voice. Thank you for showing others this. He goes, but I really like what you're doing on the ice. I like your philosophy. I like the things you're doing, because I was posting hockey stuff too. He goes, how would you like to come out tomorrow and help us do one of our skates? And I'm like, I was so nervous, but I said, of course, like I'm going, like this is NHL players. So I get there. I couldn't even get into the rink because the rink was locked because they don't want outsiders coming in Parry Sound. And, you know, I get there, it's Sam, it's John Tavares, it's Bo Horvat. It was pretty remarkable. And it was supposed to be a 1 day thing, right? I was just going to go help because they needed someone to push pucks or whatever for 1 day. And I did my thing and they kind of let me do a few of my drills and show them what I'm all about. And I was just like, okay, what a cool experience. I got a couple pictures. Thanks for having me out. I appreciate it. Like, it really helps my social media, even just being here once, to show that you guys are accepting of me. This means so much. Like, that's what I thought it was. He called me a couple hours later. He goes, hey, I talked to all the guys. He goes, they all love you. He's like, how'd you like to come back tomorrow and every day for the rest of the summer? And I'm like, yes, yes, I will be there. Right. And so that's what I did. And him and I, Sam and I, developed a very good friendship over this last year. When he came to town to Toronto, he brought me and my girlfriend down and got us tickets and paid for our dinner before and got to meet his family. And now we've, you know, again, this summer on Monday, we start again with the pros up here. So all summer I'll be on the ice with, I mean, you never know who's going to be on the ice with us. It could be, I hate to name drop or anything, but you're talking the best in the world could be there. Let's just say, you know, he just proposed to his girlfriend here in Muskoka, but you just never know. And aside from that, we've opened up other ages as well. So right down to U8, U10, kids, you know, like the whole thing. So all summer I'm full time for the next 2 months, coaching for a company called Muskoka Hockey that's owned by Sam Gagne. And, you know, I get to work with Adam Oates this summer and Adam Nicholas, who are two of the best skills coaches in the whole world. Yeah. Am I going to be doing a lot of the coaching when they're there? Probably not. But guess what? My ears are on, my eyes are on. And it's such just a great opportunity for me to learn. And I think that has
Adam Oates, one of the, if not the greatest passer of all time.
Yeah, right. And the greatest skills coach. He works with anybody who's anybody in the NHL, and he changes their game. And just such an. I was in jail 3 years ago, Jeff. 3 years ago.
I want to talk about two things. I mean, because we're just past an hour and a half. I want to talk about two things. One, and I think they're very important. One, what is your routine every day? Like, where is your mindset? Because obviously, as an addict, you're an addict your rest of your life. And I have a few really close friends that are, one is Mike Diamond. I'll probably introduce you guys. He's out of LA. He lived in New York. He used to run all the clubs. He was, you remember that show? I don't know if you remember the show Miami Inc. or New York Inc. and all those. He was one of the directors. He was on the show. This guy,
I know who you're talking about. I know who he is.
Okay, he's a good friend of mine, and we were just on the phone yesterday, actually, or a couple of days ago. But he is an incredible guy. But when you talk to him, it's the rest of your life. It's every single day you're one slip away from getting back in that world. Yeah. What do you do every single day? I'm going to ask you both questions. You can answer them. What do you do every single day that is keeping you on the straight and narrow? What's going to keep you flowing forward? And like you say, your programs and stuff like that. And the next thing is, you did hurt a lot of people along your way.
Yeah.
And you said there's a lot of friends, you use their names. Do you have a list of people that now that your redemption is starting to happen, you want to redeem them and reach out to them? And whether you have a friendship or not, just reach out and say, I'm sorry. And just redeem yourself. Your parents, your family. Is there a list that you are starting to work on? Because I think that's so important for your validation, for you to move forward, that everybody along the way that you did hurt, you're able to kind of redeem yourself.
Yeah. Two very good questions. It's changed quite a bit over the, like at first, I was just really like white knuckling it, where I got so into my podcast and answering messages on social media and feeling connected to people who were, I literally had was on the phone or texting with people who were in addiction or struggling with mental health. So it was that constant conversation where I could support them. They support me sometimes without even knowing it, just by me supporting them. Right. Like there's that. So that was a big part. I didn't have, like, I be honest with you, I was just so like purpose driven and like, okay, I need to just keep going because I'm inspiring and I held on to that. But I'm big in, especially recently, writing, journaling. Yeah. But in the morning, every morning I wake up, I have a gratitude journal that, you know, three things I'm grateful for today. What are my top priorities? What are my action steps? You know, tracking my water, tracking my sleep, you know, daily reflection at the end of the night. You know, I'm journaling about kind of what happened in the day, about, you know, did I check the boxes? Did I, you know, am I feeling, you know, all those things, right? So that's become a big part of my life, certainly in the last little while, more than even before, because I realized that I needed to take more steps to grow. I would just felt like I was stuck. And yes, maybe I wasn't using drugs anymore, and I haven't for many years, but there was more days of struggling with my mental health than I would have liked. And yeah, some did. And that's the reality. Like, yes, I was a drug addict, but I'm also diagnosed with multiple mental illnesses, you know, depression, anxiety, bipolar, ADD, like all the, I don't even know what to believe at some point, because some doctors say this, some say that. And I just, yeah, like, you know what, I got problems, but I need to find a better way to deal with them on a daily basis. Now, I've tried medications, I've tried different things. And I think if something works for you, that is fantastic. Stick with it, be open to trying new things, but make sure you ask questions, yeah, and talk to people. So the pharmaceuticals is something that I stay away from. I just, yeah, have a bad taste in my mouth from them. I'm very much into the plant medicines and the natural way of healing. Again, don't just jump into something without doing your research and education.
Of course.
I talk to a lot of people before trying different, you know, healing modalities and medicines and different things. And some have worked better than others. But yes, finding gratitude every day, keeping myself accountable. And I'm so glad you brought up the list of, you know, trying to make amends, right? We call it making amends. Yeah. And I've done it. But a long list, a very long list. And I'm proud of myself and feeling relieved that I started doing that years ago. And it was tough, because the reality is, you hurt people, they're hurt.
Yeah,
they don't forget, and they're entitled to feel however they want to feel about it. And you cannot have expectations that just because you're doing better and just because you apologize that they're going to feel any differently about you, or that they're going to let you back into their lives. So that was a tough lesson to learn. It was, I think, especially early on in the times in recovery, it was like, well, come on, I said I'm sorry, I'm getting better. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's not that bad. But I realized it is that bad.
Yeah.
So making those lists, and like I said, I don't have a ton of money even today. I'm doing, you know, a little bit better than I was, but I took a lot of money from people. So when I do speaking events, and you can get paid pretty well for doing speaking events at different times. And I always take some of that money. And if it's $50 to one guy or $100 to one guy, I might owe somebody $500, but here's $50. It's not 500, but this is what I have right now. And whether you talk to me again or not, like, and I, you know, a couple people I paid, like, you know, here's 50, here's 100, whatever. And I'm like paid off to some of the people, especially my close friends that I took money for drugs. And some of them still won't talk to me. And that's the reality, right?
Yeah.
But for myself, I know that I'm willing to take accountability, right? And ownership of my actions, whether I was addicted or not. And that's really empowering. And that's what helps me, you know, go to bed every night, knowing that I'm doing what I can. Is it enough where I want to be? And would I like to have amends with everybody and be further at? Sure. But I know that I'm doing.
You're clearing your own conscience, and all you can do is live with yourself. Exactly. And the moment you are clear with your own conscience, you can live with yourself, and you're proud of where you are as a man today. That's all that you can do. That's,
I want to quote before we get, I know you want to wrap this up, but I just want to use one powerful quote.
Yeah.
Steal it from John Gugger Mellencamp. An honest man's pillow is his peace of mind.
Yeah.
right? So that is, there's very, it's very, very powerful. And I, you know, just before we wrap it up too, being honest with ourselves and with others is one of the most powerful, and just seemingly it's like, well, yeah, you should just be honest. But especially when you live a life of addiction, you can, you just keep lying about everything. I was lying about being sexually abused from day one, putting on masks. So it's not just about like creating lies and trying to deceive people. It's living a false, you know, you're lying about who you really are and about all of that. And so being able to take off those masks, take accountability and just be honest.
I think we all wear a mask in one way or another, right? Because you're constantly trying to, as you're growing up, trying to please, trying to accommodate, right, trying to fit in with society. So you're always wearing a mask, whether you believe it or not. And sometimes those masks are very thin and they don't really have a meaning and they're just like white lies. And other times they become addiction, right? And you hide it because you're scared, right? So let's talk about your event. Tell me about your event. This is your first event you're going to be doing in September?
Yeah. I mean, first
one. And I'm sure we'll have you on. I mean, now September is quite a while. We'll probably have you on at least one more time before this to talk about it, to help push and promote it. But let me know your event and what is your goal with this event and just give me some rundown on it.
Yeah. So like I've been very fortunate that I've been able to do a lot of public speaking, certainly over the last year, all over the country, to corporations, to hockey teams, to schools. And I love it. I love it because it brings out vulnerability in people. People are always feeling, coming up to me after, hey, like I said, you know, now I'm going to go ask for help, or you know, telling me that they were abused, or, you know, kids being like, hey, I'm really going to think twice before, you know, making a decision at a party or whatever. And like, that's always been the goal. But I really wanted to spearhead an event where, you know, and start it here in Muskoka, because this is where I'm living. This is where I'm going to live, at least right now in my mind, until I'm dead. I love Muskoka. And just like anywhere, there's, though it's small, kind of condensed areas, overdoses is still happening. Suicides are still happening. We just had a young 16-year-old boy take his own life a couple weeks ago. Had a couple overdoses last week here.
I mean, you're a hop skip from Orillia, and Orillia is one of the hotbeds I had a property up in Muskoka. I sold it about a year ago, and I was up with it was a summertime. I put my two kids in the car. We're going to go up there. I had to close up some stuff on the property before we put it for sale. And on the way back, kids were hungry. Like, let's stop. I saw a pita pit in Orillia. So I'm like, let's pull into Orillia, park the car at the local library there. There was free parking or whatever it was. Let's walk on the strip. And we're there for about 20 minutes, just hitting a pita pit to grab something to bite to eat for the ride home. And I was just like in awe of what I was seeing. It was just like crackhead, like people like had crackheads in a way, just every corner. It was just like, what am I seeing here in a small little town? And then my main business is Kimura, where we design, manufacture boxing martial art equipment. And we deal with probably about 500 gyms in Ontario. And one of the gyms we deal with is in Orillia. And I remember the owner saying how bad Orillia has become for drugs. It's like number one spot apparently in Ontario right now for drugs. And so that was my experience with it. It was just about 10 minutes, and about, I was just in awe. And about 10 minutes walking up and down a strip of street, I probably saw about 20-25 people. Like, you could tell they're all out of it.
So Jeff, do you know where I told you my dad put me on a plane to Ontario?
Yeah.
I moved to Orillia. I lived there for three years. That's where the high speed chase was. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And you know, I just had a friend overdose, was it 6 days ago in Orillia? And my ex-girlfriend, the one that I moved out here for, she's living in a tent in Orillia. There's four tent cities in Orillia right now. You wouldn't even believe it. So it's, wow. You know, and I've lost quite a few friends in Orillia just in the last couple of years to overdose. It really is one of the worst towns. I always tell people that I felt safer on the downtown east side in Vancouver and more at home than I ever did in Orillia, to be honest with you.
Crazy. Yeah. One quick question here. you always hear that saying, and I remember my dad as a kid always saying to me, tell me who your closest five friends were, I'll tell you who you are. I'm sure through the process, there's been a lot of people that you've built relationships and you still hold close to your heart, but they're still in that world.
Yeah.
How do you separate yourself from that? Is it just like, I just had to stay away from these people? Because you could easily drift back towards them, right? Because they all had to hold a part in your heart. One way, like you said, an ex-girlfriend. Or how do you stay away from that? And do you stay away from that? Do you try to reach out and try to help them? Like, what's your relationship with these individuals that you've built relationships with, but you know they're still in that world?
Yeah, it's really tough, Jeff. I'll just use one example. I have a really big heart. And, you know, I have two examples. One friend who I met in Aurelia, and his mom was actually the cop that I was telling you about, the major crimes OPP officer.
Yeah.
Her son was like me, struggled with addiction, was in and out of jail. And this is a police officer, high-ranking police officer's son, right? Yeah. So it can happen to anybody. Now, me and him connected in Aurelia. We were using together and doing everything else. I found out that, you know, I got clean. I was clean for about a year. I got a phone call, and I heard this message, and it was him, and his name's Doug. And he left me a message. It sounded like he was overdosing on the phone. I freaked out and I was called his mom. I was like, I don't know where Doug is. He was in Oshawa at the time, like kind of homeless, living in like a crack shack, if you will. And I actually went, I told his mom, I didn't even know his mom's birthday. I said, I'm going to get him. Like, I don't know where I'm going to put him. I don't know where he's going to go or whatever, but I'm bringing him. And he ended up staying with me here in Muskoka for a year. And I was staying at this lady's house, a 7-year-old lady in her basement. He let, God bless her heart for everything she's done for me, but let him stay. And, you know, so he came, he moved in and he's done very well. His mom actually, he just bought a house. He's working, like he's 2 years, I think, into his recovery. So like there's that where I went, I literally pulled him out. He had a needle in his arm when I walked in and he had shooting up and everything else. Now he's working full time. He's got a house. He's got two cats. He's living in Bracebridge. He's bought a place in Bracebridge. Now we see him. But then the other side of that is I found out that another teammate of mine from junior B, like when I was 15, because remember I told you I was doing all the research on hockey players about who was struggling. So what do? You Google, you YouTube. And I came across this video of Kevin Kerbison, and the Okanagan Kelowna News did a story on him because he played in the BCHL for the Vernon Vipers, really good hockey player. And now he was homeless and addicted to fentanyl and everything else on the streets of Kelowna. Hadn't seen him in many years. I saw that video. It took me a year to find him, to track him down because he was homeless. I wanted to fly to Kelowna. I wanted to find him. Yeah. I wanted to do whatever I could. It took me a year. I finally found him. And you, if you're watching this, you can go watch the episode because I found him. He wanted to come on my podcast. It was his idea. He was homeless at the time. He did it from the street. He was in a shelter, staying in and out of shelter, but he did it both sitting on the ground in the street of Kelowna. And I ended up raising some money because I had no money, whatever. I flew him out here and got him a bed in a treatment center, but he didn't want to go and he had to detox, but there's nowhere to take him to detox. So we got a hotel for like 5 days and I was going to just watch him detox. And like, I was like a year and a bit into my recovery. It didn't go so well. Like he ended up having, you know, it's really difficult to do that. It's not like he is weak or anything like that. Like it's not easy to get off the stuff. He had just had enough. He's like, I want to go back to Vancouver. If you don't get a plane ticket, I'm going to steal a car. I'm like, you don't have to do that, Kevin. Like, cause it was like, you know, people were helping and we were trying to really help him. The treatment center was lined up and there was nothing I could do. I hugged him at the airport. And I said, Kev, like, if you get on that plane, you're going to die. And that was in March. And I got a phone call on Boxing Day. He passed away of an overdose on Christmas morning, downtown Vancouver on the downtown east side in a homeless shelter. So, you know, there's two stories to that. I think for me, I'm in a position now where I'm really strong in my recovery, where I've been able to help Doug. I tried to help Kevin and he passed away, unfortunately. But I will continue to keep those people close to my heart. And again, you can't allow yourself to get completely sucked into that, because all of a sudden, if you're, you know, you're having a bad day, you make, like you said, one decision. But I always have a place for anybody that's been in my life, or anybody that's struggling for that matter, especially if they want help, they want support, right? Yeah. And so they have to, at the end of the day, if anyone's struggling or if you're someone's watching this, you have someone that you love that's struggling, you can't do it for them. They have to do it for themselves. And I think so many people want to do that. But I know we have to go, but I just want to say quickly the event.
Yeah.
So tentative dates, September 26th, 27th. It's going to be here in Muskoka. Looks like it's going to be Gravenhurst at the Opera House. Now, my goal with it is to really, it's a pilot, and I hope that it will grow. I have no doubt that it will grow. To have a speaker series circling around mental health and addiction. So I'm going to speak. We're going to bring in other speakers. I'm hoping Justin can come out and maybe a couple others, maybe do it over a day or two. But also have local resources on hand, right, wherever we go. So we can help start bridge that gap of, you know, like people come, they feel inspired, they've gone through something, they need help or whatever. Okay, now what? Here's people that can help you, whatever. And if we went around to all the communities and did that, a lot of people don't know that they actually have a lot of resources, not a lot, but some resources in their hometown. And more than anything, I think it just creates conversation in those communities and we get back to people helping people.
I think that's the most important thing, to open the conversations within communities, and communities could be more alert about it. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really the goal. And I have dreams of kind of doing something like a TED talk, like series where, you know, it doesn't have to be me speaking all the time, but there's a lot of people that have a lot of powerful stories that can help people. And
they don't even have to be all addiction. It could be much. Yeah.
Could be amputees. It could be drinking and driving, or whatever, just anything where somebody has gone through something and they've come out the other side, they've learned something, and now they're taking what they've learned and their own experience, and they're trying to make a difference in the world to make this world a better place. To me is what it's about.
I love it.
And that's always been my MO. As a part of the, you asked me what I do on a daily basis with those gratitude journals, and like I created them and I offer them for free right now on PuckSupport.com. They're just super kind of basic, but one of the most important pieces to that of your daily kind of checklist is there's a challenge of a daily act of kindness. It can be towards yourself, towards another person, or to your community. But to me, that is like, that's a big one. Like, just go do, like, if we could all just be more acutely aware of our surroundings and the opportunities that life present us to just be kind and to make somebody else's day better or to make your community better, and we act on those, if everybody just did that, imagine how much better the world would be. So
this is something as a parent, I mean, I started my kids from a very young age. My kids are they're 15 and 17. They're very responsible. They're just good kids. They're 15, 17. My daughter's 17, super popular, great looking young lady. And she wants to hang out with daddy all the time. We hang out, we go to the gym every day together. So it's just,
you're winning, dude. You're
100%,
winning.
100%.
That is incredible.
So I've built this incredible relationship with my kids, but from a very young age, I made sure that we're walking to a mall. They open up the door. They hold the door for people. They say, thank you. A simple smile. What power is involved in the subject? Just like a simple smile. Right.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, I mean, it's starting as parents, starting from a very, very young age, I think is very, very powerful for us to do.
That speaks volumes that your 17-year-old daughter wants to hang out with dad. Jenna, my girlfriend, and I, we talk about that all the time. She had, unfortunately, her dad, she lost her dad by suicide as well, but she had a very close relationship with him. Always wanted to hang out with him. He was an incredible guy. And that's something that we've been talking a lot about. It's like that to me is, that's my goal as a parent, is to be able to hang out with my daughter when she's 17 and popular and cool and probably wants to hang out with boys or whatever, but no, I'm going to hang out with dad. So to hear that, like, this brings tears in my eyes. Like the fact that you have that, like you should be really, you know, proud of yourself, proud of your kids. I'm sure you are, but that to me is parenting at its finest right there. Your kids want to hang out with you when they're in their teenage years. They might come back usually when they're in their 20s. Like, oh, mom, dad, you know what? I wish I would have spent more time. But if that's continuous, I think that's what it should be. And I think there's just not enough of that. So that really warms my heart. That's incredible.
How does our audience get a hold of you? The website, all that stuff, social media.
Yeah. So I have the clothing line, pucksupport.com, if you want to get some merch and check that out. We are working on a new website for the nonprofit. That's pucksupport.org, but it's under construction right now. BeLeaveHockey.com is my personal website. So if you know you wanted to bring me, I'll travel around to like hockey academies where I'll spend 3 hours on the ice with the teams doing coaching stuff, and then the afternoon I'll speak to them. Right.
Yeah.
So that for any of that, you go through that BeLeaveHockey.com for speaking inquiries, that kind of thing. And then social media, my personal one, at Mental Health Hockey, all one word, of course. And then at Puck Support would be the way to find Puck Support. And we're on primarily Instagram, but Facebook, TikTok, and I'm pretty easy to find, and always open to having conversations and trying to help where I can. And that's gonna be what I'm gonna continue doing for as long as I can, is awesome. Just doing my part to be a I don't know, ignite
example change. Example.
Yes. You got it, buddy. So
I love it.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Sorry, thank you, brother.
Over time.
No, big, don't even say that. No, there's a big happens. I'm sure this relationship will continue and grow. I mean, just locally, I think there's a lot of things I could help you with, and there's things we could probably do together. This has been awesome, brother. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.